But coming back to the point about a childhood spent largely alone, one of the consequences that coming through.
Mm-hmm. Just checking.
One of the consequences of my father's condition, if you will, was a very limited social life. But it was always a great danger if one had a party, that he would have too much to drink or would, you know, just wouldn't be able to come to it and so forth. So it was a tremendous burden on my mother and then also on me. I didn't look on it as a burden, all I did, but maybe I should have been angry about it and so forth, as they say one now should, but I really just felt, you know, so sorry for him and so sad for not knowing how all of this was coming about or anything like that. So there weren't very many people in the house. He had, my mother had a few friends in Cambridge as a little Danish baroness. She was deeply offended by the airs put on by old Cambridge ladies. And as far as she was concerned, they were just all nouveau who didn't know what upstarts they were.
That's good.
And my father had a few very, very dear friends, and partly through his music, and so they would come over and he would accompany them in their singing or play two pianos together and so forth. And I guess as a youngster I just, you know, would listen to that and watch it and think, well, how good that that they liked my father and so forth. But the big formal parties and so forth were pretty much out. But in any event, the only reason I went to Belmont Hill School was because one of these persons, she was a granddaughter of Longfellow, I guess the name was Thorpe, Alice Thorpe, felt that the environment, you know, with my father being in and out of Phipps Institute and whatever the place was, Riggs in Southbridge, Massachusetts, really in serious trouble, he tried to take his life twice and so forth and so on. So it's not what you would have called an easy childhood, and she thought I ought to get out. And so she actually paid for my tuition at Belmont Hill School, and so I boarded out there. You know, it's only 5 minutes from Cambridge, effectively, but I boarded out there 5 days a week, and then would come back on weekends. And I have no way of telling whether that was a good thing or a bad thing or whatever. But in any event, that's what happened. And
did you start to pursue your, you said at this point you were already determined to do something in science. Had you started to refine that interest a little bit?
It's an important question, because the kind of interest that I developed in science was undisciplined in Shady Hill School. I mean, the purpose of the teaching there was that you become interested, not that you particularly learn anything, but that you develop an intense interest in what you're doing. So that's why you participated in Greek games, because, I mean, that became a part of you, where, you know, for the rest, Greek history is a pretty dim mystery in my mind. But there must have been something great about it, right? Because we put on Olympic Games. I mean, a very funny way of doing it. But at Belmont Hill School, I think there was essentially no science. There was no biology. There was no chemistry. There, of course, was mathematics. And there may have, I think there was a course in physics, but that was the limit. So there was no possibility of doing any science. And so it hadn't. There was no focus at all to this notion that I was going to be a scientist. I mean, my father spoke about something that meant nothing to me at all, namely physiological chemistry. Well, we don't even know what that is now, let alone then. And least of all me. But when I went to Harvard, it was I took physics and chemistry and math. And
was it assumed you'd just go to Harvard? I mean, did you think of other places, or was because you were right there, was that the...
Well, it was, I don't think we ever thought of any other place, but not because Harvard might have been the best college or anything of that sort, but because really we didn't have any money. That is, my father really never went beyond assistant professor. He retired at a reasonable age, but he was never really promoted in the School of Public Health. And he was an enormously revered teacher, and would get up at 4:30 in the morning before every lecture. He never missed lectures because of all of this nonsense. But
amazing.
It was a very, very strange life. But his students there, who at that time in the School of Public Health came from all over the world, because it was one of the outstanding, two or three outstanding schools of public health, just worshipped him. And he obviously was deeply concerned about them, about teaching them and so forth and so on. But in any event, the Depression was on, I can remember, you know, we would have meat maybe once or twice a week, and in between something which I still don't know how to make, but simulated meatballs out of lentils. It must be. And if you think that's a delicious dish, you got another thought coming. So it was a very, non-materialistic bringing up. Where, my mother was responsible for seeing that we moved from one place to another until finally we lived in a halfway reasonable part of Cambridge and so on. But it's also very important, and again, in my attitude toward money, that my mother, who worked very, very hard in a time when we had very little money, nevertheless sent a large amount of money back to particularly her sister, who had married a Lutheran minister in Leipzig. Now, Lutheran ministers were not known for the high salary that they were paid. And as you remember, 1921-22 was a devastating time in Germany of hyperinflation, and so they were always very strapped, and I just took it for granted that, you know, I mean, you didn't spend much money on yourself. You supported persons who were close to you, and you did for them, and so on. So it was quite interesting, that connection, particularly in the United States, where, as we both know, the amount of money you make is to some extent a measure of your success in the world. But beyond that, more seriously, it was a model of which said that you should care about other persons, and you should be willing to make sacrifices for them, and so forth and so on. Of course, one of the ridiculous consequences is, to this day, I mean, if somebody throws out a round bottom flask that is still usable, I just think it's a sin. I mean, wastefulness is just not in the in the proper order of the world. So it wasn't, coming back to your question, it wasn't until I came to Harvard and took as a freshman a course with Arthur Beckett Lamb, who taught the general chemistry, and he had marvelous fireworks for you. What was that experiment you did with aluminum powder and iron powder? Thermite process.
Yes, oh yes.
And sparks flying all over the people in the front row, and holes being burned in your coat. You can imagine doing it today.
That's right.
So I thought it was pretty exciting. And just to go pursue that, the next year then, as a sophomore, I took Louis Fieser's organic chemistry. And there's no question that he inspired me to go into organic chemistry. I thought that was the most exciting subject I had ever encountered in my life, and that he was so enthusiastic and in that course, he had a funny habit of giving bonus points. That shows how much mathematics he knew. So that you could get a grade of 105% by answering the bonus question. And my goal was to end up with an average above 100%. I don't think I achieved it, but I came damn close. And it was a subject that came very, very easily to me.
I was going to ask you what the attraction was, besides Fieser's enthusiasm.
Yeah, well, partly it was certainly the personal influence. And and partly it was doing exceedingly well in it. That is, that it was easy. All parts of it. Now, I don't remember, for example, that the three-dimensional stereochemical part was either easy or difficult or particularly fascinating. I just don't remember that. The fact is that sort of the three-dimensionality of organic chemistry has always been easy for me and appealing to me. But I don't know where the devil that came from. I don't think you could say, because you certainly could say that that Fieser's course, which was as it turned out, woefully out of date. In 1932, it must have been, I guess, when I took it. It was probably a good course around the turn of the century or a little before. But there was no question that that's what locked me in. And then then I guess it was the next year. I'd have to go back, and it makes no difference whether it was the next year or my senior year, but I think it was probably the junior year that I took this Chemistry 105 Advanced Organic from Kohler. And the intellectual level of that course in mechanistic terms was, it isn't a question of its having been far above what Fieser taught. Mechanism for Fieser was one molar equivalent of lassos. I mean, if you wanted to know how a reaction went, you had to know where to place the lassos to eliminate HBr or whatever it was. That was mechanism. And so I realized immediately, I just had to sort of forget the whole way of thinking that whatever it was that I had got from Fieser. And start to relearn. So but by that time I was totally locked into organic chemistry.
What kind of laboratory work had you done with Lamb and with Fieser in those first 2 years? What were the lab courses like?
Well, as far as the manual part of organic chemistry is concerned, I think I should go back further. As a young child, let's say 8, 9, 10, I can't possibly remember when, with plenty of time on my hands, I became enormously infatuated with making model airplanes. And with the amount of money that we had, and in any event what was available, there were no kits available, and you glued things together. You glued the pieces that were already cut. I mean, if you wanted to make a propeller for this little plane, you started with a block of balsa wood and a knife, and you cut it out. And if you made one false cut, then that piece of balsa wood and that propeller was lost. And that little block in my memory, cost a lot of money. It was a precious thing to have a little block of balsa wood. So I spent a lot of time doing that. And in retrospect, it seems quite clear to me that that developed a lot of, what's ordinarily called manual dexterity. Beyond that, a real liking of working with my hands as opposed to working with my head. And I don't think there's any question that that's where it started, because all through the years at Belmont Hill School, there was no laboratory. I can't begin to remember what the lab was like in Lamb's course. I'm a bad person to do an interview like this because I have an absolutely lousy memory for detail and anecdotes and things like that. And I guess the Fieser experiments were straight out of his book, mm-hmm. a green book, yes. I remember it. But he had a wonderful thing that anybody who took his course at that time would remember and would recall for you. And that is, at the end of the course, he had a competition So of the 100 or whatever it might have been, 150 kids who were in the lab, the teaching assistants would pick out a few who seemed to have more ability in the lab than others, and there'd be maybe 20 of you that would line up one afternoon and be given this sample of, oh God, what was it? I know what the end was. It was luscious yellow. And it's a famous thing that's in his book.
Yes, yes, I know.
But in any event, you had to run through 7 steps or 5 steps or something like that, and it was a race against time. You know, to see who could, and you had to get everything crystal and take a little sample, you know, at each stage, put it in a vial, label it, put a cork in it, and you had to do this. You planned ahead, of course, but fundamentally you were given the stuff, and then you had to go through these 7 operations. And I was, and he had done it in 4 hours, and was terribly proud of it. Louis was a baby in so many ways, it's just not describable. During the war, when he got into napalm, the pleasure he got in building these little wooden houses out between Converse and this in the yard between that laboratory and Washington, he'd alert everybody that he was going to be testing the next sample of napalm. With no feeling of human compassion, what am I involved in? What am I doing? This is going to be used to put globs of burning gelled gasoline on Japanese or whatever it was, and just be an absolute kid as this thing would go up in flames. So anyway, I was determined that I was going to do it faster than Louis had. Now where that feeling of competition, of competitiveness comes in, I don't know. Because it doesn't seem to me to be reflected in other parts of my early life, and so I just whipped through that damn thing, and I got through in 3 hours and 40 minutes. Then the teaching assistant, who realized there was going to be somewhat of a competition, said, "Look, well, we judge both the time that it takes to do it, but also the quality of your samples that you submit, and one of them is a little off color. Wouldn't you like to take the opportunity to recrystallize?" And I said, "No way! I'm staying with my 3 hours and 40 minutes." So the answer is, where did I learn to not to work with my hands so much as to enjoy working with them? I think it comes way before that, and you just came into that laboratory course knowing whatever the substrate was, you could handle it, and you enjoyed handling it, and you took pride in how you handled it, and that's really true. I mean, that expresses my my feeling toward experimental work.
And you're taking math and physics along in those first few years at the same time?
Yes, yeah. And math came fairly easy, very easily for me. It was very easy for me up to a point, and then it was as if one hit a wall, the kind of thing that marathon runners talk about, where then the next course was just incredibly difficult, not making any sense, or for reasons that I don't know at all, and that was the end of my math. And it of course, later with deep regret, so much so that from my own experience, I've certainly advised any number of younger persons to take as much math as they possibly can, because you're not going to be able to learn it easily later in life. In fact, you're not really going to be able to learn it. It'll never become a part of you. You may learn the operations or the techniques or the rules for doing it, but it's never going to be your language. And in the way when you that you sense it is, or the only persons I've ever talked to, really theoretical physical chemists, persons like Kirkwood and Hansager, I mean, for whom, you know, looking at an equation is a language, and it speaks to them. Well, I've got to try to figure out why is this in the denominator, and, you know, why is that an integral, and what does the integral mean? And for Hansager, that's just a language. He just reads it in the way that certain musicians can sit and read a score and hear the whole piece. And that's the way of, I mean, those are the persons who really handle mathematics. Well, I wasn't in that category.